This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Lin Mark, Wang Shanning and Julian Ng, who's just broken into dance in the studio to illustrate happy he is to be with us.
That's fake news.
No, it isn't.
No, we saw that, Julian.
You're just taking advantage of the fact that our listeners can't actually see you.
Yes, I do that a lot of times.
In addition,
I'm in my shorts right now.
In addition to your super yoga moves that you did yesterday, right?
Oh yeah, that's right.
And apply sunscreen in the studio, but never mind. That's another story for another day.
All the
things
that happen
behind the scenes. There's so much you can do, when people can't see you.
Well, how are we this morning? It is a Thursday, the 12th of March.
I know, just one more day to the weekend, actually, and I'm kind of looking forward to it because I think we all need a break from. I would admit quite recently a lot of bad news, and we need a little bit of a cheer.
At least a break from the bad news.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of a refresh. This is partly why I try and avoid reading the news as much as possible during the weekend, because we do it all through the week. And this is the fact of life, right? Most 90% of the news you read in the newspapers or on the news portals, it's bad news.
Yeah, but it's made worse by the fact of this COVID-19, right? We seem to have increasing infections in Malaysia. People seem to be very nervous, about it. And I don't blame them because the death rate is higher. And talking about COVID-19, a lot of companies are in this BCP mode, right?
And what is BCP?
This is, some people call it business continuity planning. Some people call it business contingency planning. Same, same.
Process also can.
Yeah. But basically, is whether, when there's a crisis, can companies continue to function? And, that's one of the questions we're going to ask today, whether companies are actually ready for it.
Yep. And I think the COVID has also thrown other things into disarray. For example, the stock markets in the world, as well as Bernie Sanders' unfortunate losses so far in the primaries taken over by Joe Biden. I guess people are a little bit afraid of giving the mandate to Bernie Sanders, who is a little bit more radical in the current economic situation. But everyone also knows who Warren Buffett is. But very few know who Benjamin Graham is. And he is, in fact, the mentor of Warren Buffett. He wrote the book called Intelligent Investor. And he's asking you to look in the mirror right now as to what to do with your investments. And we shall talk about that.
Now, if you want to weigh in on those conversations, you can. The WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. Or you can tweet us over at BFM Radio. First up, though, we're taking a look at commutes to work and whether or not if you do work during your commutes, should you be paid for that time? Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. That was Red Hot Chili Peppers with Aeroplane, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lin, Shanning and Julian. Now, commute to work.
New word.
Every
new
morning.
Word.
chances are there has been a time when you've whipped out a phone or a laptop and maybe done a little bit of work while you were sitting in that train or in that taxi, or even, maybe in the middle of while you're waiting at a traffic light, to get a bit of a head start on your workday. The question is, if you do regularly work on your commute to work, should you be paid for it? Because this is something that has come up in Switzerland. So Switzerland in January changed the rules so that its employees only need a sign-off from their manager in order to actually count their commute to work as part of the working day.
I think the alternative title to this article, which is from the BBC, is Should You Be a Slave to Your Company, right? And whether companies should count the time that you use in your own free time to do work for the company. And I think the straight answer to that is yes, the company should pay you for that. But Malaysia is one of those countries that haven't ironed out all the kinks there are to, for example, addressing workers' rights. There are many kinks there that are not completely ironed out compared to those countries in Europe, which of course have done that, and every little thing that is added on top of it, they will analyze and ask whether workers should be paid for this. For example, in Malaysia, the minimum wage, 1,200, I don't think that is a perfect solution for minimum wage. I think the better metric there would be the minimum hourly wage, because you can give someone 1,200 a month and work that guy to death. You know, so I mm-hmm. think it's still unfair, including the time for when people commute to their work and doing work at the same time.
And that 1,200 is not even in some places considered the living wage, which Bank Negara placed at 1,600.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean 1,200 if you live in urban KL is honestly way not enough, right? It probably doesn't even cover most of your rent, and I don't even know how you make ends meet to even afford to eat anything. But I wonder whether Europe takes it a little bit too far also, you know, especially Northern Europeans, where they really are very strict about working hours. Like in France, I think it's a maximum, if I'm not wrong, it's 35 hours a week, and they enforce it strictly. But for companies, and for, does that result in actually a higher cost? And as a result, your economy suffers, you know. But there's, my point about this is that I don't know whether there's a balance, because on one hand, I think, yes, sometimes you just need to put in those extra hours. There's no running away from it. For example, now with BCP, most of the companies in BCP, I think there has to be some flexibility, right? Because not everybody's working together in the same office. So some people have to do more on certain days because they are the ones in the office versus the team that's at home. So how do you actually balance this out, you know? Because ideally there should be some work-life balance, but we know that that's almost a myth.
I think it has to be a trial and error, because the way Europe has done it, basically, it very different from what the kind of perspective that we see here in Malaysia, is that they are very focused on the long-term health and productivity of their workers. Right, because if you have a work-life balance, if you are strictly held to that 35-hour a week, you're less likely to burn out. You know, as I think is what we risk here in Asian countries. Like, I have lawyer friends, particularly, who go into work on their let's say they put in for a holiday, right? And they put in for a couple of days leave, and in those days up until they take that leave, they're working every day until 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and coming back in at 7 or 8, that's not a life, you know?
Yeah, I think that is a function of corporations not respecting the rights of their staff. But it's sometimes also about the entire package, right? You're paid for the end result that you're going to deliver to the companies, and not necessarily, especially at senior levels, counted for actually the quantity of hours that you put in, but rather the quality of the product, the work product that you deliver. I mean, if you walked into a cake shop, for example, and you take one cake, you pay for that one cake. If you take an extra one, you have to pay for that as well. And so that kind of cake principle should apply to employees' time as well.
But also, different people do work at different speeds, right? Say, maybe you do work a lot faster than me, Julian, so you'd be able to finish baking that cake in a shorter time. But there is also the expectation in a lot of companies that you still have to be present at work until the boss leaves. Right.
Yeah, that's a very Asian culture thing.
It is.
Yeah.
And no matter whether or not you finish work, you could be playing Minesweeper on your computer, for all that anyone would know, because you finished everything, but you can't leave because it will be seen as you slacking off if the boss is still in the office when you leave.
That's why I support the working from home policy, because at the end of the day, we want to be adult about the whole thing. And of course, we are still fine-tuning this idea of working from home. But, you know, you are delivering an end result rather than being micromanaging what happens in between.
And we're going to be talking about that, working from home and how to set up remote teams, in just a bit. But remember, if you want to weigh in on any of our conversations, you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got some messages coming up for you. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was See Fernando by Jenny Lewis. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Shouning and Julian. Now, in this age of COVID-19, there are a number of companies who have started to look into or have already set up remote working strategies. So perhaps half your team stays in the office, half your team is working from home or working from elsewhere. And the question is, you know, if you haven't done it before, how do you go about setting up a kind of remote team that will be effective and yet retain some of that, I think, the social aspect of generally working in the same office? Because when your entire team or half your team is working individually in different places sprinkled over the Klang Valley, you know, you can't exactly get together and chat over the water cooler, you know, mm-hmm. In order to spontaneously generate ideas during a break as you would in an office.
Yeah, the COVID-19 is making people very lonely. So some of the strategies of working remotely have to be accompanied by such social aspects. I think the most challenging thing I find about COVID-19 is it's impossible not to touch your face. I can't get used to that. So it's very dangerous. And the World Health Organization has of course, declared COVID as a pandemic now. So it's even more serious for all these things to be implemented.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there are serious consequences by actually that declaration alone. I mean, there will be economic ones, of course, and social ones. But it just means that, you know, things are probably just going to get much worse than we originally thought. But I think for me, you know, this COVID-19, the one thing, and this is coming from a team perspective when you're working, because we're not I would say we're still in touch remotely for sure. I mean, we have all these apps and tools, video conferencing, Google Hangouts, but it just doesn't replace that human interaction, which I miss very much. And you're right, it can be lonely. The other concern I have is, yeah, you can do all this, but can it overcome things like, you know, a bit of a low morale because we're not together and there's that sense of COVID-19 out there, a little bit of fear, right? And as a team, we can't approach it together because you're in your house, some of us are in the office, some people are somewhere else. There isn't that sense of, it doesn't replace that physical bondness that we have as a team, I think, especially for the morning run.
So Fast Company has an article looking at 8 strategies to set up remote work during this outbreak. And, you know, I look through these 8 strategies and some of them I think are a little bit out there, right? So one of them is creating a remote first experience. So this article says, you know, in Slack perhaps or any similar work performance or productivity tool, create a channel where employees can spontaneously issue high fives to each other.
Okay, please don't do that.
I think that's really an extreme part of giving an answer to the loneliness problem, right? Mm. I don't think that really solves the problem, but I think the principle behind that is that you keep in touch with each other and you try to present a view of normality even though you're just separated from one another.
Yeah.
But on the whole, I think the loneliness problem is not so bad because when you're at home, you still get exposure to other people that's not normally present in your workday. So that, in a way, takes away that loneliness. And if all else fails, there's still Netflix, right?
Well, not all of us have people in the home like I don't. But, I mean, I just miss the interaction and the bouncing off of the ideas. And it somehow is never the same whether if you use Slack or you use WhatsApp, you know, because things do get lost in translation versus saying it and then typing it. And sometimes, you know, admittedly, when you type it, it comes across not necessarily in the best way. And people can't, you know, so the context is lost or the expressions on your face are lost, which are so important.
It's very important to find the right emojis.
It is.
Or GIFs.
Or even the right GIFs. And I've actually been in situations where I've been in a remote working team where we mainly communicated through Discord, which is a variant of Slack. It's very similar. And they had specific channels dedicated to just what they call GIF spam. Right, mm-hmm. So just sending funny GIFs that you find throughout the day or sending a meme to kind of replace that, you know, that those spontaneous moments sitting in the office where you kind of see something funny and you poke your head up over your computer screen and say, hey, Julian, I just found this really cute thing. And then you turn it around and show it to you, right?
Yeah.
So that would be the online equivalent of that. But at the same time, you know, when you're in a working environment, it can be nerve-wracking to do that, to set up that kind of a channel in a space where, you know, your boss is present, right? So there is something to be said for the flexibility that has to come from the top when it comes to remote working. But do let us know, nevertheless, what you think. What would be the best way to set up remote teams? Do you have any tips? You can WhatsApp us at 01878988999 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 news coming up for you. you. But first, here is Back in the Life Again by Steve Winwood, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Revelry by Kings of Leon, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lin-Mark Wong-Shaning and Julian Ng. Now, the markets have been extremely volatile over the past couple of weeks, you know, with COVID-19 following closely on the heels of previously the trade war and a wider economic slowdown. And the question is always, if you are an avid watcher of the markets, what do you do about it? You know, and there is some advice perhaps to be had from Benjamin Graham, who was the mentor of the very famous Warren Buffett, who basically says, you know, forget about trying to predict what the stock market will do. Instead, focus on what you as an investor would do.
Yep, absolutely. And Benjamin Graham is famous for writing this book called The Intelligent Investor, which is a textbook that every investor should read if you really want to excel, if that's even possible, excel in the game of stock picking. This is a kind of Bible or textbook. But essentially what he's saying is that you got to invest according to your risk preference. And that means you got to invest according to how you can avoid getting stressed out by the market. For example, in this time when the markets are crashing and the Wall Street Journal has already declared that the decade-long bull run has ended, we are officially in a bear market. If you want to avoid being stressed out in the current market, what you should have done is to have a proper asset allocation in investing more in assets like bonds that will be exposed to less volatility in such a time. And right now, if the markets have crashed, you wouldn't be so worried. In fact, you can transfer some of those bond investments into equities.
Okay, this is all very good in theory. Okay. Unfortunately, I mean, it's the markets are something which I think psychology, you know, I think investors underestimate the power of psychology. Because there is nevertheless a lot of greed and fear out there. And over time, I think unfortunately, fund managers behave, if you ask me, professional investors or institutional investors, behave a little bit like lemmings, right? Because everybody heads in the same direction. And yeah, there are some investors that actually make a lot of money by not following the crowd or following the trend. And people like Benjamin Graham and even Warren Buffett are those. But they have, I would say, honestly, nerves of steel, because when you are watching the market collapse, you know, like let's say 7% every day, 10% every day, which has been happening, 7% this last night, mm-hmm. Slightly less than 7%, and then 2 days ago, down 7%. You know, is it possible for you to retain your sense of calmness like these people? It's not always so easy, right? I mean, these are useful tips. But as the markets are crashing, I think it's human reaction to kind of panic. But like what Benjamin Graham says is true. Timing is actually something we shouldn't try to do with markets. And unfortunately, we'll get into that kind of that mode, right, where panic takes over.
Actually, what this is talking about is just a question of how much sugar you put into your tea, right? If you don't want your tea to be too sweet, and the sugar being the stocks, then you put less. Some people go without sugar. And when the portion of the sugar itself crashes, you can add more sugar, right?
No, but this
but
is
if your
this...
tea if your tea is too sweet, then you will be exposed to the degree of stocks that is in your tea, and therefore that makes you worried. So if I were a bond investor right now, I would not be so worried because I'm insulated. I'm in a safe haven. And if I had allocated 100% of my portfolio to gold, I also would not be very worried right now. So what he's saying is that you should structure your entire portfolio
based on your risk appetite.
According to how much volatility you are willing to take.
Yeah, but even then, I think everyone at this moment is uncertain about markets. So yes, you can have the perfect asset allocation. You can come up with an asset allocation which theoretically matches your risk appetite and what you want in terms of rewards. But when the markets are coming down 30-40%, I can tell you that fear will remain, even though you know you are in all supposedly whatever safe haven. an asset. That concern is there. Now, how do you remain calm, even if you have got that perfect asset allocation?
So what you're saying is that for a person who has allocated 90-10, 90 to bonds and 10 to equity, this guy would be worried right now?
I don't think so. Because sometimes the yield would have come down.
That 10% would have become 5%, in which case they can transfer some of that bond money to reallocate to equities.
Yeah, but at some point you think, hey, you know, the yields have come down so much, the price has gone up. What should I do now? Should I sell and then should I switch? So these decisions are still decisions that are on your mind. Maybe you're sitting from a nice, comfortable position, but it doesn't take away from that concern that, hey, what should I do at this moment? And then timing comes in, right? Because do I sell bonds at the peak of the market?
Yeah, and if the markets
do crash,
you buy.
Well, according to Benjamin Graham, yes, you do.
Yeah, but
yes,
so, you know,
because,
this is...
Because over the long term, equity outperform bonds, right? We've been to many crises, and we've had the benefit of looking into the past, 1989, the late 1980s, 1997, 2008, and now 2020, they always recover. But the question is whether you can take that short-term exposure to a big fall in markets.
Well, do let us know what you think about this. You can WhatsApp us. The number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got some messages coming up for you, and then we're taking a look at the front pages of the newspapers this morning. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was The Best of It by White Horses, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Shunning and Julian. So we're taking a look at the front pages of the newspapers this morning. I actually have the Malay papers in front of me for a change, the first ones. The Sina Harian is in its second day of talking about their exclusive, which they had with Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, the former Prime Minister now. And he's made some interesting comments. So, of course, he said that, you know, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin's cabinet is going to be watched very closely. He still believes that the culture of kleptocracy exists in Malaysia. He's of the opinion that the Malay community don't have much trust in Datuk Sri Anwar Ibrahim because of his liberal stance. And I mean, he's also put the blame of all of this entire, I think, debacle on Datuk Sri Najib Razak.
Yeah, and it was very interesting yesterday that Prime Minister Muhyiddin asked for Mahathir for endorsement of his government.
Yeah.
So it's going to be very interesting if Mahathir actually agrees to endorse it, which means that Mahathir has been adopted into the new government.
Yeah, so Sina Harian did ask him this, you know, whether he was ready to give his support to Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, and he said not at this juncture.
So he doesn't completely rule it out. Well, interesting. So what happens when Parliament reconvenes in May? Big question.
Yeah, that is the question. But then, because
I think he also conceded that they would not win the no confidence motion.
Yeah, because they lost some of their statutory declarations, right? So even people who signed SDs and then subsequently turned up in the cabinet lineup.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in relation to that, Prime Minister Muhyiddin has set up a new economic council, according to the Edge Financial Daily front page, to address economic woes. And at the same time, in the side column, there is also the news of 20 new COVID-19 cases in the country, bringing the tally up to just a touch under 150.
And for Malaysian Reserve, I mean, being a business daily, their headline is hotel room cancellations hit 67 million ringgit in just 46 days. And this is because the Malaysian Association of Hotels noted that between January 22nd and March 9th, this was the figure. And, you know, those were the early days of COVID-19. What more now, right, when we are, you know, at peak infections globally? There's also another sidebar saying more initiatives to address flagging economy. I think this is asking the cabinet what they're going to do. And quite an eerie picture of Melawati Mall, because it looked completely empty. I think there was a case there. So, you know, I think I won't be surprised if this is also the picture of many other malls in KL.
So the Star's front page has gone with a wide-angle picture of the entire cabinet sitting around a table with the headline "Priority to Revive Economy." So this is as Prime Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin chaired his first Economic Action Council meeting, which we're going to be talking about a little bit later this morning. And of course, and taking a look at page two in a sidebar, there is the column aid for those affected by COVID-19, because the government has announced a COVID-19 fund that it's going to be giving financial aid to those directly impacted by the outbreak. So I think one million ringgit has been channeled into the fund so far, and that's to help COVID-19 patients and those under the 14-day quarantine but are not holding on to any jobs.
And just looking at the online portal Malaysia Kini, the most read story over there is the health director general has confirmed that a Malaysian man at a religious gathering has been diagnosed with COVID-19. So the fear now is whether all those at the gathering would have been exposed to this guy.
Yeah, and the Malay Mail, which is of course now online, their headline, World Health Organization calls coronavirus outbreak pandemic for the first time. I think the last time they did this was H1N1. Ten years ago. SARS.
More than 10 years ago.
So, you know, clearly I think this is something very serious. And even in Malaysia, I think the last count is 149 COVID infections in this country. But and that number will probably rise at 4:30 when the Director General actually normally has his press conference.
So the Malaysian Insight has gone with Azalina's, the latest in Perikatan Nasional's ranks to slam Muhyiddin's cabinet choices. And this is Datuk Sri Azalina Othman, who was the former law minister. And I believe she said, this cabinet was not proportionate to the parties in government. So in other words, there probably should have been more UMNO MPs, in her opinion. And of course, also, we have a story from... Also, the TMI has gone with comments from Barubian, former works minister, confirming he is an independent, refuting reports that he has joined Bersatu. Now, that is all of the news from the front pages of the newspapers that we have for you this morning. But after the 7 o'clock news bulletin, we'll be back with more business news as well as a look at the markets. So be sure to stay tuned for that. But for now, here is The Prince by Madness, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.